Hello and welcome back to the 1951 Down Place Podcast, everyone. And a very special thank you to those who are still subscribed via their podcatcher of choice. For those who may not remember, I'm Scott, one of the indentured servants here at the podcast. Now, this is podcast episode number 58, and it's been a while since number 57, since August of 2016 to be exact. By now, you might be wondering, where has Down Place been all this time? Believe it or not, we've been on an extended cruise aboard a tramp steamer to the exciting Lost Continent in the Sargasso Sea. The Lost Continent was very relaxing, but it didn't have any Wi-Fi, so we had to take a break from podcasting. Besides, El Supremo forbid us from recording anyway. Now that we've returned, we're going to take a look at Hammer's 1968 film The Lost Continent, starring Eric Porter, Hildegard Knef, and Susanna Lee. So what did the Down Place crew think of their visit to the Lost Continent? Did they eat too much at the all-you-could-eat buffet aboard the ship? And did the entire crew survive their visit? Well, we'll find out right after this note from one of the show's newest sponsors. Are you tired of visiting the same old places on vacation? Does the beach hold no interest for you anymore? Are you sick of overpriced theme parks and wearing mouse ears all the time? Well, we've got the vacation for you. Hi, I'm Giddy Up and Go, owner of Get Up and Go Travel, where we specialize in the strange and unusual destinations. We can take you to the Lost Continent to see the man-eating seaweed and interact with the local members of the Spanish Inquisition, because nobody expects that on vacation. We can also fly you through the Bermuda Triangle, where a full third of our clients have returned. Or for the fully unique, how about a trip to Point Pleasant, West Virginia, where you might meet a Mothman. Just leave your sweaters at home. And for the budget-minded, a trip to the mystery spot in Santa Cruz, California may be just what you need. So remember, don't take an upside-down vacation. Call Get Up and Go and ask for me, Getty and Go, for all your stranger vacation things. Get Up and Go Travel, a proud sponsor of the 1951 Down Place Podcast.
C-3PO.
Loki.
Mace Windu.
Dr. Bruce Banner.
Captain Rex.
Venom.
Princess Leia.
Jean Grey.
Darth Maul.
Nick Fury.
Grand Moff Tarkin.
Captain America.
Lando Calrissian.
Cyclops.
What do all these characters have in common?
Well, two of them were played by Samuel L. Jackson.
A couple of them were played by Hammer Films veterans Peter Cushing and Christopher Lee.
Come on, guys. You know this.
Well, of course we do, Jessica. Just like Mickey Mouse and Captain Jack Sparrow, they're all now Disney characters. Hello, I'm Tracy of the Disney Indiana podcast, and my co-host Scott and I enjoy talking about all aspects of the House of Mouse, and that includes their newest properties, Marvel and LucasArts.
We also talk about Disney resorts, the cruise line, theme parks, and whatever else Mickey has to offer.
Which includes movies, Imagineering, video games, and collectibles. You'll never know what we'll decide to talk about.
So check us out at www.disneyindiana.com or do a search for the Disney Indiana podcast on iTunes, because now we've got a lot more to talk about.
And don't forget about those other quote-unquote Disney characters like, well, Sully.
Fozzie Bear.
Buzz Lightyear.
Link Hogthrob.
Doug.
Janice.
Merida.
Pepe.
Bruce.
Ralph the Dog.
Wally.
The Disney Indiana podcast. Even after 5 years, we are still miles away from the nearest Main Street, USA. We are not listed on the map, but you can join us at www.disneyindiana.com.
The people of her kingdom called her She Who Must Be Obeyed. And she was immortal. She.
She has returned to haunt the living and revenge the dead. She has returned in the form, the face, the beauty of the screen's most exciting new star, Olenka Berova, the vengeance of She.
Aisha has been reborn. She is mine.
Aisha!
The all-woman goddess returns to bring more men to their knees and new worlds to their destruction. The Vengeance of She.
Prepare
Prepare for a spine tingling, nerve shattering podcast featuring all your favorite monsters. You won't believe your ears when you listen to Monster Kid Radio. Hear your host, Derek M. Cook, and his ever-rotating stable of guests discuss your favorite classic and sometimes not-so-classic monster movies. Subscribe to Monster Kid Radio through iTunes or Stitcher, or visit monsterkidradio.net before the next weekly episode of Monster Kid Radio. Go through the archives for interviews with Sarah Karloff, Victoria Price, and Joel Hodgson. Listen to discussions about movies like Creature from the Black Lagoon, Island of Terror, and King Kong. And don't forget convention coverage from Monster Bash and the H.P. Lovecraft Film Festival. Classic Monsters, Modern Talk, and the head of Rondo Hatton, only on Monster Kid Radio!
This is Victor Von Psychotron, host of Weirdorama, and you are listening to 1951 Downplace, the place for Hammer film knowledge on the web.
You know, I want to get this out of the way first. I want to beat Scott to the punch specifically because I'm going to start that over. We are way out of practice. I'm way out of practice. Okay, starting it over. Take two, three, two, one. You know, let's get this out of the way first. Let's make the joke first before we get too far into this, because if we don't, it's just going to be hanging over our head. No one expects the Spanish Inquisition. Just saying.
I figured you were going to go with some sort of four-sided triangle reference.
Oh, it is 1951 Down Place. It's been a while, and I am here, and Scott is here. Where's Casey?
I think he fell overboard into the seaweed.
Oh, no. Oh, well, show must go on. Anyway, Scott, how you doing? Oh, it's been a while, Scott. How long has it been since we've done 1951 Down Place?
Oh, you catch me right off guard here. Was it maybe August 2016?
It's been a while. It's been quite some time. And I've addressed this a little bit on Monster Kid Radio. We have talked about it on Facebook a little bit. Just, you know, real life got in the way. Job situation changes. Somebody passed a kidney stone while recording, and then we threw him overboard to the seaweed.
But we kept the stone.
But we kept the stone, yeah. So that's our co-host this time around. It's me, Scott, and Casey's kidney stone. Welcome back to 1951. Wow. Anyway, it just real life got in the way. There's a number of things that happened, and we just had to dial things back, and 1951 Down Place took the hit. Scott's still been doing his thing at Disney Indiana. I'm still doing my thing at Monster Kid Radio, and Casey, I think, is still doing things elsewhere with Bloody Good Horror and such, or at least his kidney stone is. So, I mean, we're still around, but the show took a hit. Well, we're bringing it back. Casey has moved on to other things. It's me and Scott right now, and we're going to talk about a movie this week this month that Scott wanted to talk about for his birthday pick, which would have been what, last November?
Yes, November 2016. And before we get too far away from Casey not being here, if Casey has happened to listen, if he ever wants to come back as a one shot or a guest host or something like that, I'm sorry, your kidney stone has taken your chair. No, that's not true. If he ever wants to do a guest shot or something, you know, reach out to us. We're not kicking him off if he has things in his life going on. So just wanted to make sure that everybody understood that.
Yeah, it's not bad. And nothing's bad. It's not like, you know, Casey got really sick or anything negative happened. It's just his job situation changed. He needed to do a lot of in-home training. I believe it was in-home. Anyway, he had to train for his job, and just life, man. This is how it is. None of us are making a bunch of money doing this podcasting thing. So,
and as we always said, we were all had shows before Down Place, and if anything needed to be cut because of life changes, it was always going to be Down Place.
Right. Now, hopefully moving forward, we're not going to see Down Place take the back seat as much, but we did make some changes to how we're doing Down Place. You want to talk about that, or you want to wait to the end here?
Oh, I think we should talk about it because this show is going to adhere to those changes.
True. So Scott and I have talked, and while Casey is welcome back at any time, Scott and I will be the main hammer dudes here at this point moving forward on the show.
The hammerheads.
The hammer. There we go. That's a lot better than hammer dudes, isn't it? But now yeah. I want to see somebody Photoshop us onto some hammerhead action figures from Star Wars. Anyway, moving forward, it's going to be Scott and I, and then whoever we bring in, if we're going to bring anybody in down the line. Still kind of sticking to the same format in terms of talking about a singular Hammer film every episode. And there might be a few special things here and there, but we're going to get back to covering one film an episode. And how often are we going to do the show?
Did we decide on that?
Well, I thought we talked about maybe going quarterly, at least yes. at first.
Okay. Yes.
This is why you should probably have a meeting with your podcast co-host before you start recording.
I thought this was the meeting.
Oh, okay. Okay. Yeah, I think we're going to go quarterly moving forward. Now, if things change and it becomes possible to do more than that, awesome. But at least to kind of ease back into doing things for a little while, we're going to go quarterly at this point. Does that sound fair?
Sounds fair to me.
I wasn't asking you. I was asking Casey's kidney stone.
I need to get a Sharpie and draw a little face on him so I know which way he's looking.
Also, 1951 Down Place is no longer its own thing. We're going to incorporate it, fold it into the Monster Kid Radio Network, which by the time you hear this will be a thing. So, yay. I don't know what else to say to that other than Monster Kid Radio is going to be growing a little bit, adding some new things, some bells and whistles, something I do need to talk about with Scott off mic down the line about what to do about that. Yeah, it's going to be part of the Monster Kid Radio Network, which means you're probably going to hear a little bit more talk about 1951 Down Place and Monster Kid Radio proper, maybe a little bit back and forth, just to kind of cross-promote a little bit more and have a stronger web presence. I'm even considering changing the feed a little bit so that we don't have to rely on archive.org. But again, that's all behind the scenes stuff Scott and I will talk about. Unless you want to talk about it now.
Okay. I'm just honored that I am now an official part of Monster Kid Radio. I've just been a guest, but now I'm a pseudo official part of it now. I feel special.
See, I've always kind of viewed you, Scott, when it comes to Monster Kid Radio, as like the Paul Simon, the Steve Martin, you know, the five-timers club, basically, from Saturday Night Live, the Tom Hanks of Monster Kid Radio. You've come on so many times, you may as well just be an official part of the show, even though you're not in the opening credits.
Well, see, I thought you were going to go more like I was the John Oates or the, you know, the one that they don't talk about too often. The Garfunkel.
Oh, there you go. There you go. Now, we do need to get you back on MKR proper down the line. And that, again, is a conversation we need to have off mic. Because that's not why listeners are tuning into 1951 Down Place right now. They don't – well, they may care about what's going on. But they're not here to listen to Monster Kid Radio Administ Trivia. We're here to talk about Hammer films.
And we might do that over there as well.
Yeah, we very well could. There would be some spillover, some crossover. I have talked about The Gorgon with director Joshua Kennedy over on Monster Kid Radio. Can't remember the episode number right now, but I have done some Hammer stuff over there. With 1951 Down Place coming back and being part of the network, I feel a little bit more comfortable about having more Hammer conversation on MKR. I was always trying to keep it separate for a while since we had Down Place, but now that we're kind of together, I feel a little – it's all about me is what I'm saying. I feel better now. Anyway,
so what Casey's yeah. kidney stone, are you okay with all of this?
I was about to ask, we need to tune into Casey's kidney. We need like a little voice like I'm fine.
You know, now a little part of me hopes that Casey doesn't listen to the show.
Oh, so that recording that I was mentioning where Casey practically passes a kidney stone while we're recording, which was brilliant audio, by the way. I don't know why he didn't. Yeah, anyway. What movie were we talking about when that happened? Do you remember? Because we recorded two episodes that never made air.
Yeah, it's one of those two, and it's actually locked on a laptop that I'm having technical issues with. And that's why it's never been released. But I don't remember the film we were talking about.
It was not The Unholy Four, which was one that we had recorded as well. And it was on a hard drive that crashed, so I don't think I have access to that anymore. Was it Curse of the Mummy's Tomb?
It might have been. Yes, it might have been that.
I'm looking at our old episode list over on our website, and that was what was after the Unholy Four. So I was sitting on the Unholy Four. I was editing that, and listeners of MKR know that I had a hard drive crash, and while most of that data has been recovered, I don't think the audio from that recording has been recovered, and I don't think you've got it anymore either because it was on that other laptop, right?
Yeah, it's on the other laptop that will not boot up for me.
And then we had Curse of the Mummy's Tomb. Now, if they ever become available, the audio files, I don't see why we couldn't put it out.
That'd be a very special edition of Downplace.
Yeah. A flashback episode, right?
Yes, yes.
There we go. Oh, boy.
And I did the hands, too. Of really course. Really great for an audio podcast.
See, we're out of practice. That's the thing. And so those episodes may turn up down the line. Even if they don't, though, I wouldn't mind going back to Curse of the Mummy's Tomb with Scott just because I've got a mummy thing, you know, mummy fetish. And
I remember not hating that movie. I don't remember what I thought of it, so I'd probably have to watch it again.
All those Hammer movies you've watched over the years just kind of blended into one giant Hammer film.
Yes. Yes. It's called The Muppets Take Manhattan.
Okay. Wow. All right. Well, on that note, what are we talking about this time around? And it doesn't have the Muppets in it.
No. Well, almost it does.
Well, yeah, I guess it does.
It's The Lost Continent from 1968.
Here, where a million years are but a moment. Here, where the present and the past tremble in the presence of the prehistoric. From here comes an adventure so big that only the big screen can do it justice.
What is it?
The Lost Continent, discovered in all its monstrous horror.
Never come across anything like that before.
A living hell that time forgot. This is the man who brought them to the Lost Continent to face the terrors of the past.
Save them!
Save them!
The Lost Women on the Lost Continent. Her past drove her here.
Didn't expect me to leave with nothing.
Her future begins here. His life could end here. Now the horrors from the past meet headlong with the terrors of the future.
Well, that's because it's dry. But that one drop of water, touch it.
You will see torture pits for forbidden lovers. Barbaric sacrifice. Monster weed attack helpless beauties. Seed. Giant mollusks. See them fight to the death. Seaman struggle to destroy the evil of the Lost Continent. From the novel Uncharted Seas by Dennis Wheatley.
Look out on the starboard side!
A living hell that time forgot on the Lost Continent.
This was originally a birthday pick for you.
Yes.
Why?
When I attended a monster bash a few years ago, it was Hammer-centric. And I only caught maybe the last 10, 12 minutes of this film in a showing. I was doing some other things and missed the beginning of the film. And I was really intrigued with the last bit of this film, and I wanted to see the rest of it. So I thought, since at that time we were doing the Hammer podcast, that I would save it and view it as part of 1951 Downplace.
Okay.
I had never seen it before other than the last few minutes of the film.
All right. And I'd never seen it before at all. So this was a first time viewing for me. Now, people who have been with Downplace for a while know that when we started the show, Scott was the newbie. Over the years, we've watched so many Hammer films. I mean, I don't know if we can call you a newbie anymore, but this is still a new viewing for you and for me. So I'm excited to talk about it. It's not something that either one of us have a lot of preconceptions about other than the last 10 minutes that you saw. Mm-hmm. This should be fun, I think. I hope.
Now that we've seen it, we'll determine if it was fun or not.
So the movie came out in 1968, and it's one of three films that was adapted by Hammer from a Dennis Wheatley novel. What were the other two movies? You remember? Do you know?
To the Devil a Daughter is one, but I'm not sure what the other one is.
Why am I drawing a blank? Oh, The Devil Rides Out. What is wrong with us?
Which that one we did. That one we covered.
Yeah, which I confused the two in my head. Yeah, The Devil Rides Out was actually in production around the same time at the same studio. They were shooting in Elstree. And a couple of times, Christopher Lee would come over to the set for this one. There are a couple of pictures of him visiting the set of The Lost Continent because they were all shooting at Elstree at the time.
And he was a huge fan of Dennis Wheatley's novels.
Right. He was actually a big part of the reason why Hammer picked up the rights to a couple of these, to three of these. He was actually a neighbor of Wheatley at one time. And it was through Lee, my understanding, that Hammer became aware of the possibility of maybe doing these as films, and some connections were made that way. We have not done To the Devil a Daughter yet.
No, we have not.
Have you seen it?
No, I have not.
I have heard about it because it's kind of notorious regarding Natasha Kinski's part in the film, which maybe someday we'll talk about down the line. We were going to do it like last year, but yeah. Back up like 15 minutes to hear why we didn't do it. Anyway, why the show went on hold. Anyway, compared to The Devil Rides Out, what do you think?
I like The Devil Rides Out better.
Yeah, me too. A lot better. And I'm going to blame that or maybe thank the director for that. Terrence Fisher is a much better director when it comes to this kind of stuff. Not to say that Michael Carreras is a bad director. I mean, he actually seemed to enjoy directing, but he wasn't the first guy on deck to direct this film. He was a replacement. Leslie Norman was originally signed on to direct, and Leslie Norman directed X the Unknown, and he was a replacement director for the guy who was originally going to direct that. Now, we did talk about X the Unknown a while back. Check out our episode list page for that. But Leslie Norman was replaced. I still don't know if I know why. Did you find anything?
I read that he was removed, and that it's really unclear if he actually did any filming. He did some pre-production work, but I never did understand why or read why he had been removed.
I had read that maybe he had done some of the dialogue heavy scenes, but that was about it, that he wasn't involved with the production very long at all, that Carreras came in.
There's a lot of dialogue heavy scenes, so it's a little hard to tell where that would have been.
Yeah, especially at the beginning of the film, mm-hmm. before everything kind of goes down. But Michael Carreras is here. He adapted the film. He used a screen name. I believe he's the name Michael Nash this time around, but he's used other names before. Michael Carreras is the son of James Carreras, one of the founders of Hammer. So if you know Hammer, if you know Hammer history, you know who Carreras is. He also directed one of the Mummy movies. He's also credited with creating or directing what's considered the first spaghetti western, which isn't a Hammer film at all. But it's interesting when you look at Michael Carreras' filmography, outside of what he was doing with Hammer, he really didn't like a lot of the quote-unquote horror movies that they were doing. He thought the Mummy movies were fine, but he wasn't a big fan of Dracula and Frankenstein, even though those were the moneymakers. He wanted to do other things, and that might have been why he was gravitating toward The Lost Continent, as he saw that more as an adventure fantasy film.
Yeah, he was also good friends with Dennis Wheatley as well.
Okay.
And in fact, I found a quote from Carreras talking about that, saying that he was the only person that Wheatley ever invited on his birthday for lunch. I don't know if that's true or not, but that's something that Michael Carreras had said.
Huh. Well, then, I wonder what Dennis Wheatley thought of the film.
Well, now that you say that, Carreras did say that Wheatley quite liked The Devil Rides Out, but did not understand The Lost Continent.
Oh, okay. Could it be because there's really not a continent to get lost on? But yeah.
That's a red flag for me when you take somebody's work and adapt it to a screenplay and then they don't understand the movie. That's a little worrisome to me.
There's a throwaway line in the book Hammer Glamour by Marcus Hearn, which is a wonderful book, not just for the pictures, the section on Susanna Lee, who's one of the characters, one of the actresses in the film. It's just a throwaway bit. This isn't an interview with Susanna Lee. It's just something the author says. The Lost Continent is a would-be epic based on a book that prolific author Dennis Wheatley confessed he couldn't even remember writing.
Hmm.
Well, okay. I know Wheatley wrote a lot, and he's most known for like the occult investigation, dark magic stuff. So this isn't exactly in what we would call his, I don't know, better known wheelhouse. But still, I can't imagine writing a book and just kind of like forgetting about it. Unless you see the movie and then you get so lost, like, oh, I wrote that? Yeah. Oh, I don't remember that.
I did like the tribute to Wheatley in the film. There's a quick scene with one of the characters when we first meet him. He's actually reading one of Wheatley's books.
The book that the Lost Continent was actually based on.
Yes.
Uncharted Seas is the name of the book, which would have been a better title, I think, for the film.
I do too.
But maybe I'm getting ahead of myself. I think something that we've established over the years with Downplayers is that whenever we talk about a Dracula, a Frankenstein, or even a mummy film, one of the quote-unquote gothic horror films, tons of material out there for us to read. Tons of research opportunities for us. When it comes to the more fantasy, the adventure, the film noirs, any of these non-horror type projects, it gets a little more difficult to find a lot of material, but it sounds like you've got some.
I did find in one of it's the Big Red Book by Kinsey.
Hammer's Film Legacy.
Yes, that's the one.
Quatermass to the Devil's Daughter. Great book.
Great book. He has a section in there on this film where he talks about Christopher Lee actually was considered for a role in this film. He was going to be offered a non-speaking, non-credited role. And this was actually revealed in the 1967 edition of the Christopher Lee Fan Club Bulletin.
Wow.
Which I would love to get my hands on some of these and read them.
Yeah, no kidding, right?
But it stated that Christopher Lee, that after The Devil Rides Out, he has tentatively agreed to work on Michael Carreras' production of Dennis Wheatley's The Lost Continent in a non-speaking part with no billing or mention of any kind. And Christopher Lee went on to say, at least this will give the audience something to think about.
Okay.
Now, he was going to play the part of the masked inquisitor that we see at the end of the film as a part of the Spanish Inquisition. What's interesting is that once Christopher Lee backed out of that role, the role actually went to his stunt double, Eddie Powell. And Powell, when he was offered the role, he said, is there going to be any dialogue? And he was originally told, no, there's not going to be any dialogue. However, he was then surprised to find out when dialogue was actually written for him. Now, he's a stuntman. He's not an actor. So he admitted that he muddled through that. But that was just the start of his adventure on this film. Because for the unmasking scene of the Inquisitor, he had to go through a 4-hour makeup job.
Wow.
And he speculated that maybe why Christopher Lee backed out of the role. And furthermore, the scene that he's unmasked is also when the Spanish galleon is set on fire. And he's supposed to go down on his knees and read the Lord's Prayer. Well, he said, when that was going on, it's off camera. You can't see it, but my feet are literally on fire.
Wow.
So he's reading that and trying to rub his feet to get the fire to go out in his feet.
I wonder why Christopher Lee didn't want to do it.
Yeah.
Well, Eddie Powell, we've seen quite a bit in other Hammer films. He, like you said, he's Lee's stunt double, so we've seen him without really knowing it was him and just assuming it was Lee. So at least it's somebody in the Hammer family, but yeah. Anyway, it would have been cool to see him.
Yes.
But speaking of the Hammer family, we do have one of the mainstays, one of our guys, the man who's appeared in more Hammer films than Cushing and Lee. We got Michael Ripper, man.
Yes. I did not know he was in the film. Longtime listeners of the show will know that that was somebody that I didn't know who it was before we started doing this podcast.
Now you see him everywhere.
Yeah, he shows up in probably 90% of the films we talk about.
Yeah, Michael Ripper, man. What a pleasant surprise to see him turn up in this. And of course, he's turning up in a role that's typical of Michael Ripper, probably on set for like 3-4 days tops. Not a very prominent role, but he's there and you can't help but just feel warm and fuzzy when you see the guy because he's, you know, he's Michael Ripper, man.
Yes. And I would imagine he went through a quite a long stint in the makeup chair because they've got one of his eyes completely closed with a nice scar over it.
Yeah, he looks really good.
He does. He
looks really good. You want to talk about the rest of the cast? Anybody else that stood out for you?
No, actually, nobody really stood out to me. And the interesting thing after watching a lot of these Hammer films is, and I'm just going to say it, it's the Hammer glamour. You usually have really striking looking women in this film and films that seem to be missing in this film. To me, anyway. I mean, they weren't exploited like they normally are.
So let's talk about the women in the film. There's three women that are featured prominently in the film. One is Hildegard Knef, or Neff. I'm not sure on the pronunciation of her last name. This was, I believe, her only Hammer project. She was a German actress who came over and tried to make a go of it in non-German films. My understanding, she may have escaped a prisoner of war camp. I'm not really sure much about her background, but apparently there's a lot of controversy. She was in a movie called The Sinner in Germany in which she did like full nudity, and it was like, so of course Hammer's like, yeah, come on over. not that they exploit her or anything like that. I mean, she's older in this film, and she's a handsome looking woman, but she's not what you would consider the Hammer glamour of the film. You're looking more at Susanna Lee or Dana Gillespie as those pairs. To put it bluntly, I mean, this is what, late 60s Hammer, so they know how to light and shoot cleavage.
Yes, they sure do. But I didn't get that feeling from Susanna Lee as much. As, you know, the outfit that they had Dana Gillespie in was definitely showing off the cleavage. I didn't get that from Susanna Lee at all.
No, I didn't either.
It was an unusual role for a woman in a Hammer film.
How so?
Well, I mean, the way that she was portrayed, the character that she was playing, she was more forceful type of woman. I mean, she was under her father's thumb, but once he was out of the picture, she was very forceful. And I have not seen that too much in Hammer films before, unless the woman is a vampire.
Oh, good point. Good point. Yeah, she plays a character by the name of Unity.
Yes.
Unity Webster. And yeah, she's under her father's son. I would say, though, before the father leaves the picture, she's still a little aggressive, a little assertive, because she's a little horn dog.
Yeah.
You know, she to be blunt about it. And that's fine. If that's, you know, no judgment here, nothing wrong with that. You know what I mean? Just not exactly what you'd expect from a non-vampire female in Hammer, even in the late 60s. You're absolutely right.
She knew what she wanted and she went after it.
What about Dana with her balloons? I'm sorry. Apparently, at some point on set, she turned the corner and said, one of my balloons is flat. And everybody stared at her like, what? Okay. Anyway. Dana Gillespie. Had she done any other Hammer projects other than this? Do you know anything about her?
I know very little about her. And she's not in this film all that much.
No, she's not.
I mean, she shows up at the end. I mean, we'll talk a little bit about the structure of this film. But when they actually get to the Lost Continent is very close to the end of the film. And she shows up there as a character who I have a hard time understanding the population of the Lost Continent. is there multi-generation of crews that have been there? Is she a Viking? What is she?
I don't know, but I think you're absolutely right. And, you know, I'm checking her filmography and we have seen her before, Scott. She's a party girl in The Vengeance of She.
Oh, boy. Girl at party. Yeah. Okay. Yes.
So I have a quote from Gillespie, okay, talking about how she got involved with the film. This is from the relatively recent issue of Little Shop of Horrors magazine, number 37, which actually is all about the Lost Continent. So nice timing. All right. Here she says, in an interview, she recounted how she ended up with her role. Well, they wanted somebody, quote unquote, big. Anyway, they said, do this day's shooting with Alenka Borova on The Vengeance of She, and if we like you. And from that, they gave me a proper screen test to do. And then they said the part was yours. And by somebody big, Gillespie is referring to her eye-popping 44-26-37 figure. The article continues. They hadn't invented cleavage, but Hammer certainly perfected it. Gillespie ended up filling out her costume more than just about anyone who had worked for the company since Marie Devereaux in The Stranglers of Bombay. I feel like I need to watch The Stranglers of Bombay again.
That's a good film. Yes.
Anyway, yeah. this is the 60s Hammer. I mean, it would get really bad in the 70s, but this is late 60s Hammer, and they knew where their bread was buttered. Mm-hmm. And you know, they brought her in, and she's okay in the film. She's, like you said, not a big part of the movie until towards the end, and even then.
Yeah, I'm not sure. I mean, she leads them off the boat at one point, but to where, I don't know. I mean, she keeps...
The motivation is off.
Yeah.
It's off.
She keeps talking about her people will be needing her, but she never says who her people are. And it's really... I don't understand a lot of the stuff about what's going on the Lost Continent at the end.
Yeah.
But her character and why the rest... I mean... I can understand maybe why the guys are caring about her and why they go off looking for her because of the measurements you mentioned earlier. But is that enough to go risk your life for? I don't know.
Yeah, I don't know. The motivations are just weird. There is one interesting character turn in the movie that I really appreciated, and that has to do with the drunk and what happens with Unity's father. I like the consequences and the fallout of that. But the rest of the cast, we've got Eric Porter playing the captain of the ship, Captain Lanson. Unity's father, Dr. Webster, played by Nigel Stock, who apparently was Dr. Watson for some BBC Sherlock Holmes stuff. I don't really know as much about it as I should to speak to intelligently about it. We've got Jimmy Hanley, who's the bartender who does turn up a couple of times in the movie. You think he might not be an important character, but he does turn up towards the end of the film, or at least at the 2/3 mark.
And why isn't Michael Ripper playing that role?
I know, right? It really should have been him. It really should have. Oh, well. The drunk, was that Harry? Was that Harry Tyler?
Yes.
Okay, he's played by Tony Beckley. And if there's anybody you'd have to say is like the protagonist of the film, once you get to that halfway point, I'd say it's probably him, because he does go on that journey of changing character growth. Although that growth just seems to be like turning a corner and that's it. There's not like a gradual moment.
I would argue that journey is more taken by Captain Lanson than him.
Yeah, I mean, I can see that too. I mean, as the captain, he does start kind of shady.
Yes.
He's got a ship full of Chekhov's explosives.
Yeah. whose bright idea was it to take an explosive that will explode when touched by water and put it on a ship?
Yeah, on an old ship.
That has tinfoil for the sides.
Pretty much, right? Oh, wow. Anybody else we need to talk about cast-wise? You want to talk about El Supremo or El Diablo or whatever he was?
How old was he? That's what I want to know.
Yeah, he was just a kid. He's played by Daryl Reed, who would later go on to become a musician, kind of a rock star type. He unfortunately passed away a few years ago. I think it was a traffic accident of some sort. And he did write a memoir. We can't remember the name of it. But most of it is about like the debauchery of being a rock star, not like his background as an actor or whatever. But yeah, he was pretty young. He was born in 51. This movie was what, 68? So what is that? Yeah. Teenager.
Yep.
Who also takes a drastic, like 90-degree turn in character. Just boom, boom.
Yes. No motivation for that turn at all.
Yeah. Yeah. It's odd. Anyway, we're talking about cast. We're talking a little bit about crew. Is there somebody in the crew that you want to mention as we lead into some potential Disney connections?
Well, I've got some James Bond connections too.
Okay. Well, I mean, we already talked about it being shot on Elstree Studios, which is where a lot of James Bond stuff was shot. And I even have a picture somewhere around here of Roger Moore visiting the set. So there's a connection. But what do you have?
Well, first off, we have James Cousins,
okay,
who is the chief engineer in the Lost Continent. And his name was Nick. He was also in 1974's The Man with the Golden Gun, playing Colin Thorpe, an MI6 ballistics expert.
Okay.
Colin Thorpe is presented during Bond's briefing with M, along with Bill Tanner, as they discuss the golden bullet supposedly sent from assassin Francisco Scaramanga, a.k.a. Christopher Lee.
Do we need to pause for a second for Casey's kidney stone to go Scaramanga, Scaramanga?
We have Sylvia Henquist, who plays an uncredited traveler on the boat, and she actually appears in two James Bond films. She is a Japanese fan dancer in silhouette in the title sequence for You Only Live Twice and the Jamaican Girl on Her Majesty's Secret Service. Alf Joint, who was crewman Jason, was a stuntman on two Bond films, Goldfinger in 64 and on Her Majesty's Secret Service in 69. On Goldfinger, he was actually Sean Connery's stunt double. Eddie Powell, who was the Inquisitor we talked about already. He was a stuntman for many James Bond films, including From Russia with Love, You Only Live Twice, Diamonds Are Forever, Live and Let Die, The Man with the Golden Gun, The Spy Who Loved Me, For Your Eyes Only, Octopussy, Never Say Never Again, A View to a Kill, and The Living Daylights.
Take a breath.
And in The Man... Pardon?
And then take a breath.
Yes. And in The Man with the Golden Gun, he was the stunt double for Christopher Lee. Moving on to my Disney connections, Reg Lai, the helmsman in The Lost Continent, plays a prisoner in the 1979 Disney film The Unidentified Flying Oddball.
Okay.
Now, there was a couple of stuntmen that I mentioned during the Bond section. Also worked on several Disney projects, including Elf Joint crewman Jason. He was a stuntman on The Return of the Jedi.
Oh, okay.
Eddie Powell, the Inquisitor, performed stunt work on Indiana Jones and The Last Crusade. And what I thought was really cool is he is the xenomorph for the stunt work in Alien and Aliens.
Wow.
He's the main xenomorph. And besides being a highlight of his career, I'm including this work as Disney connection because the Great Movie Ride at Disney's Hollywood Studios has a section where you go through the Nostromo.
Really? Wow. Okay.
I just think it's cool. He is the main xenomorph.
Okay.
In both of those two films.
That's cool.
The director of photography for The Lost Continent, Paul Beeson, worked on several Disney films, including Raiders of the Lost Ark, Indiana Jones and the Temple of Doom, and The Last Crusade. And Willow for Lucasfilm, along with Who Framed Roger Rabbit and Swiss Family Robinson for Disney.
Okay.
Assistant director Dominic Fulford was the second unit director for Star Wars, The Empire Strikes Back. And the special effects monsters in The Lost Continent were created by Walt Disney effects expert Robert Mattley. Now, Robert Mattley won an Oscar for his giant squid in 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea and came out of retirement in 1975 to supervise the animatronic shark in Jaws.
Nice.
Now, longtime listeners will know that at this point we normally go into Doctor Who connections. And Don Falco is... provided those in the past. And I thought it might be a good idea to have somebody who actually watches Doctor Who read these connections. That way I can't make mispronunciations of these. So Don Falco is back with the Doctor Who connections. And since he's a podcaster himself on the 2 Minute Bible podcast, he recorded them for us.
Hello, this is Don Falcos with Doctor Who connections to the Hammer film, The Lost Continent. Let's start with Dennis Wheatley, the author of the novel on which the movie was based. In a Doctor Who novel titled Time and Relative, there is a rumor going around Coal Hill School that there are novels by Dennis Wheatley in the school library. The rumor proves to be false. Tony Beckley, who played Harry Tyler, played Harrison Chase in The Seeds of Doom. Mark Heath, Customs Man, played Ralph in The Moon Base. Victor Madern, Mate, played John Robson in Fury from the Deep. Reg Lai, Helmsman, played Griffin in The Enemy of the World. Donald Sumpter, Sparks, the radio man, played Enrico Casali in The Wheel in Space, Commander Ridgway in The Sea Devils, and Rassilon in Hellbent. He also appeared in an episode of the Doctor Who spin-off series, The Sarah Jane Adventures. Alf Joint, Jason, was stunt arranger for Battlefield. He was also uncredited as a thug in The Ambassadors of Death and as a stuntman, an IMC guard, and a primitive in Colony in Space. And just in case Scott didn't already mention this, his stunt work has featured in several James Bond films, including Goldfinger, in which he was Sean Connery's stunt double. Eric Porter, the star of The Lost Continent as Captain Lanson, has no direct Doctor Who connection. However, There have been many references to Sherlock Holmes within the Doctor Who universe, and of course, Dr. Moriarty is an important Holmes nemesis. And of course, Eric Porter played Moriarty in the Jeremy Brett Holmes series. Okay, it's a stretch, but as a Holmes lover, I couldn't resist. And finally, Nigel Stock, Dr. Webster, played Professor Hayter in Time Flight. He also appeared as Dr. Watson in the BBC's 1960s Sherlock Holmes series opposite some guy named Peter Cushing. And that's it for Doctor Who connections to the Hammer film, The Lost Continent.
So that is my Bond and Disney connection, and Don with his Doctor Who connections for The Lost Continent.
Well, thanks, Don, for sending that in. Appreciate it. And we get another voice in the mix, which is always nice, I think, to get some variety. Since Casey Sidney Stone has been notoriously quiet this episode, it's good to have somebody else's voice in the recording.
Now, if I was thinking ahead, I would have asked Don if it was okay we credited him as Casey's Kidney Stone.
Oh, there you go. You know, I said something earlier about how, you know, none of us are doing this podcasting thing as money. We got day jobs and other things and all that. But what if we had some merchandise? What if we sold like little plush Casey Kidney Stones? We figured out a way to market those.
I bet he wishes it would have been a plush one.
Maybe we could get like some tennis balls, put some googly eyes on it. You know, spray paint it like brown or gray, you know?
Holy cow, tennis ball size. That hurts me.
But it's got little giggly eyes on it. You can't be mad at that, right? You say that, yeah. Speaking of somebody who's never had kidney stones, man, I could hear the distress in Casey's voice, and I felt so bad for him.
I'm in the same boat. I feel sorry for Casey and just made me want to drink more water.
You know, I wonder if we can recover the audio. Maybe we can just find the bit where Casey starts groaning and just use that to go out on. Just work that into the end credit music. No, that's terrible. Oh, Casey, we love you, man. Anyway, the film. So The Lost Continent, it does follow Uncharted Seas for about the first third of the movie. And then the movie takes a drastic turn away from what the book was. And part of it was because Carreras was like, I really like the stuff with the Spanish Inquisition. I want to play with that more. And apparently that's not as pronounced in the book. In the book, there's like three different islands or mini continents that they can go to. One of them's overrun with giant crabs and other civilizations, things like that. But you don't get this in this movie. I don't feel like we ever got a Lost Continent. Am I wrong?
No, you're not wrong. And this goes back to a little bit of what I saw of this before watching it this time. I was teased with the good stuff.
Oh, okay.
It's not really a Lost Continent, more of a mischarted island.
Oh, okay.
Maybe. It's an area that's out in the middle of the Sargasso Sea. That's not on any charts or anything. But it's mostly inhabited by, there's a small outcrop of islands, maybe a couple of land masses, little small ones. But it's mostly some really creepy, evil seaweed that traps boats there.
Evil seaweed.
That's right. Or cicada seaweed is what it sounded like.
Yeah. I thought that was cool. I mean, the seaweed was cool. I would have set it on fire right away. But, see, so they got to wait until the end of the film before they decided to try to burn it. But I thought that was kind of a neat little touch. I wasn't expecting that. I don't know what I was expecting when I got into this movie, to be honest with you. I was expecting, I don't know. Because I couldn't, I don't know. Go ahead.
I knew the seaweed was coming because you see it, or I saw it in what I'd seen before. But at that point, it was past the scene where the guy gets dumped in the hold where the seaweed is. Mm-hmm. So I never saw anybody actually killed by the seaweed. So I didn't know what it was and why they were walking the way they were walking across it. That was all new to me. You know, of the reasons why I saw it, but I didn't know what was going on. And I didn't know if it was land that they just couldn't touch. Maybe it was burning them or something. Because once they establish it, they don't really reference it too much more. I mean, they establish that first off, it'll grab a hold of your skin and squeeze and, you know, break into your skin. And then it will also, if you fall completely overboard, it will just consume you.
as a monster design, I thought that was kind of cool. And
yeah, I did too.
When you do see the one in the pit where they put him in the hold and the El Supremo kills somebody with it, I actually backed up a little bit and it's like, whoa, I want to see that again, because I thought it looked cool. I know it has a puppety kind of look to it, but it didn't have the traditional, what I would consider traditional Hammer monster look. I mean, it didn't look like something from Quatermass in the Pit. It didn't look like something from a gothic horror. It looked floppy and gross.
Yes.
In a way that I hadn't seen in other Hammer films.
I mean, honestly, the closest thing it looks like is the Sarlacc pit.
Right.
From Jedi.
Pre-special edition.
Yeah.
I thought it was kind of cool. Just kind of floppy.
Yep.
That's what it needed, with a sound effect. You know, it's... No, I wouldn't need that at all, actually. I would ruin it. But no, I thought it looked kind of neat. I liked it. And I liked how it handled consuming people. I liked the way it killed people. No, I thought it was neat.
Yes. And it's telling that you and I are immediately going to the end of the film and talking about that first.
You know, the structure of this movie, I've seen some sources say it's very similar to the structure of the original King Kong. I don't agree with that. I feel like this one kind of loses its way as soon as the hurricane hits. And we spend the entire time trying to catch back up with whatever the story was supposed to be.
With the title, The Lost Continent, and what I had seen, I was really hoping they would get to the island quicker. I think I think they spend way too much time in the first half of this movie setting up all of the characters, and the ones they spend the most time setting up leave and mutiny and take one of the lifeboats and leave. And the characters we're left with, some of them they don't set up well at all.
Right.
And I don't know their motivation. I don't know why they're there. And that goes to a lot of the passengers on the ship. There's only one that I think that is fully fleshed out, and I understand why she's there and everything. And that's the woman who was in love with the president of some South African country or something.
Hildegard's character.
Hildegard's character. She's the only one that I think is fully fleshed out, that I understand her motivations of why she's there.
Right. And I mean, I feel like there's a little bit there with the doctor. Now, I'm reading in some of these magazines and such that I'm trying to find information about. Did they ever say exactly why he was driven out of where he was driven out of? Because when I read that he was an abortionist that people tried to get rid of, that I don't remember that being brought up in the movie.
I remember her daughter making some sort of offhand comment that he was sleeping with his secretary and patients.
Right. Yeah.
But I don't remember anything about abortions.
So that kind of caught me off guard and paints that character in a slightly different light for me than what we actually got in the movie. And I think this movie has a whole lot of great intentions that just they never really follow up on.
The problem I have with him is it's mentioned that he's kind of overbearing on his daughter, and that he is in control of her trust from her deceased mother. But none of that is really explained a whole lot. I mean, they spend more time explaining that he was sleeping with a secretary and his patients.
Right.
I want to learn more about what happened to the mother. Did the doctor have anything to do with it? Why is he in control of the trust now? It just seemed like we were told a little, but not really what's germane to this story and the relationship between the father and the daughter.
Well, it's not like he makes it to the end anyway, right?
True.
He ultimately becomes the trigger, the catalyst for the drunk to stop drinking. Cold turkey.
Cold turkey. But before that scene comes up and to talk about the drunk, I don't understand his motivation at all. I mean, his backstory. Why is he on the ship?
Yeah.
And that's one thing. One big problem I have is they have this ensemble of characters, but they don't give you much of why these people chose this tramp steamer passage instead of an actual cruise line. I mean, they mention that they could go on a regular cruise, but no, every single one of them chose to be on this ship. And then there's this great scene when the second in command finds out that there's a hurricane coming and the captain decides to go straight for it. And he says, well, let's go ask the passengers. And they go down and they ask the passengers, do you want to go to a different island and wait out the hurricane, or do you want to go right through? And every single one of them voted to go through, but what were they running from? Why would they be willing to risk their lives to go through a hurricane? It seems like, you know, I told Tracy at that point, we're going to find out some really interesting backstories of why these people are on the run, and we never do.
Eventually, we find out about Hildegard and the one person that was following her. I mean, I guess we can understand why he's there. The captain is doing some shady things. But yeah, why is the drunk there? What is he? Is he just a drunk? Is he running from some debts? Is he so far gone? Who knows?
Yeah.
Although I did like that he was playing the funeral dirge on the piano in the lounge when all this was going down. I thought that was nice. That was a nice little touch.
Yes.
Oh, man. You know, so the hurricane hits. You mentioned the hurricane. And so what? I don't understand.
Well, before the hurricane, we've got to also find out that the captain has made this shady deal to transport some explosives. And I want to know how the captain was able to get all those explosives on board with none of the crew knowing about it.
Right. When the first officer, whoever sees it, it's like, oh, this is the first time you've seen it. This is your ship.
Yes.
Why do you not know what's on board?
I mean, Michael Ripper's character is in there. He's one of the first that also discovers it. And they don't know what it is. They just see all these yellow cans. And, you know, they think it's explosives, but they don't know what it is exactly. But it's like, what did he send all of the crew off for shore leave? And there was nobody on the boat except for him and whoever he was buying it off of. And they loaded it.
Yeah, I don't know how that happened. But it's basically phosphorus. Yeah, it's an explosive phosphorus. And there's a concern if you get it wet, it's going to blow everything up. Well, okay, one, why is it on the boat then? And two, we see the barrels get wet. Water is splashing on them and nothing's happening. So I don't know.
I'm thinking those are really watertight containers they were in. It's the only thing I could think of.
Anyway, can we talk about what happens after the hurricane or with the hurricane? Can we talk about why the captain decides he's got to kill anybody who leaves?
We can talk about it. I'm not sure if I can answer the questions.
So, Captain Lanson, you said earlier that, you know, if there's like a true protagonist that goes on a journey, maybe he's the one. And I think maybe he does, but
he starts off, we find out that he owns the ship, but the ship is literally a junker. I mean, it's in rough shape, and he reveals that this is his last trip. He's going to, when he gets to Caracas, he's going to sell the ship and retire. And then also make all this extra money by illegally transporting this explosive, I guess. And he decides that we're going through this hurricane, and anybody who disagrees with me is going to be shot. You know, we're going to do this. And that's when it kind of sparks the mutiny. And as the mutineers try to take over, and then they decide they're not going to take over, they're actually going to take one of the lifeboats and leaves, is when the captain comes out and starts shooting them as they're leaving, which I can understand. I guess a mutiny, you're supposed to shoot the mutineers, I guess, but
sure. Sure. Okay. Next time I'm in the car with you and we're on a trip somewhere and I suggest we go a different way, I'll make sure there isn't a gun nearby. He's like, Scott, you should turn here.
I got to shoot you now. You're a mutant. Yes. But then we find out later through the events of the film, he gets more caring about, cause he also doesn't care at all about the passengers. In fact, he's got Hildegard's passport in his office locked up and he ends up giving it back to her. And, you know, at one point she starts to tell her story and he's like, I don't get involved in other people's problems. But then later on she opens up again and he listens, and I almost think those two characters are starting to fall in love by the end of the movie.
Sure. I think there is a connection there, and it's an interesting connection. And you can even see a little bit of jealousy on him or in him when he stumbles across her and the person who was sent to follow her and retrieve some of this money. Ricaldi, I believe his name is.
Yes.
Okay. And he's played by Ben Carruthers. You see, you say he's kind of turning, maybe softening a little bit. What I struggled with, though, is that at some point he's given the opportunity to save Ricaldi's life. And he doesn't.
And he doesn't.
He actively chooses to let him go. And I don't know if it was like a jealousy thing or, you know, I have eyes on Hildegard. How dare you? I don't know. But there's still this weird active moment to just let the guy die.
I guess I didn't see it that way because at that point, for some reason, Unity Webster is making moves on Ricaldi. And when this sea creature attacks and grabs Unity Webster, that Ricaldi actually grabs a fire axe and starts cutting off the tentacles and frees Unity. And this is where the monster then attacks him. At the same time, the captain comes in, and I think the captain makes a choice to save one. He can save one or the other.
Oh, okay. Okay.
I didn't see him as Ricaldi, you're going to die because I choose to not save you. He was going to save Unity because she was free of the tentacles, but she was also knocked unconscious.
All right. Well, he dies.
Ricaldi dies. Father,
yeah, Ricaldi dies. Unity's father is earlier when sharks got him because Harry Tyler punched him out and knocked him into the water and they couldn't get him out fast enough. There's a handful of people who die, nameless crew members. One of them takes a flare gun to the chest, which I thought was kind of cool, actually.
Yeah, I thought that was shot well. He decided that we're not going to bring these people back and share our rations with them. And he gets a flare gun in the chest for it.
I can't remember the exact line, but it's something along the lines of too many of us and not enough supplies or something like that.
Yep.
And when there's a mini mutiny happening on the lifeboat, I think the guy's trying to take out the captain, isn't he?
Yes, he is.
And Hildegard grabs a flare gun and shoots him in the chest with it, which I was like, well, that was cool. Nicely done. There's a more gruesome death, though, that kind of happens mostly off screen where the lifeboat's being dropped during the hurricane and somebody gets caught up in a chain that zips back up into the boat. And
actually, he doesn't die there. That's the cook that's later eaten by the seaweed.
Oh, even better.
Because he's the one that they bring back in, and when the drunk is playing the funeral dirge and the doctor's trying to save him.
Oh, that was him, huh? Okay, I guess him. I didn't realize that was him. Okay.
Yeah, that was him.
Okay, yeah, what was the cook's name?
I don't remember if he ever had a name.
Hurry Curry. Okay. I kid you not. Anyway.
But yeah, he's the one that, because they get him on the lifeboat, and they build a little shelter for him from the sun. But he kind of goes crazy and once they see the seaweed, and the seaweed gets him.
So I thought this was a stretch. After they survive the hurricane, they're on the lifeboat, they get out, a few people die along the way, whatever. They find a boat, and it happens to be the ship they were on to begin with. I thought that was such a stretch, man.
With the bartender drunk.
Yeah, yeah. And it's the same boat, and apparently that happens in the novel too. And they just go back on board like nothing ever happened. What?
I thought that was a stretch because the two vehicles have different mass and the seas and the wind would take them in different routes. I don't think they'd ever see each other again. But I could be wrong.
Yeah. How many? You're about to go on a – well, you've been on cruises. Does that happen? Do you ever like get off the lifeboat and then just hang out?
Knock on wood, I've never had to get in the lifeboat on the cruises I've been on.
Anyway, they get reunited with the ship, and that's, I would think, where they were going to run into the Lost Continent, but really they just run into a bunch of seaweed that slows them down and women with balloons.
Well, the seaweed doesn't slow them down as much as take them to where all the other ships are.
Yeah.
Because the seaweed jams the rudder and the propeller, and they just kind of float along with the direction the seaweed's going. That's where they run into the Vikings and the conquistadors and the religious zealots and a weird conglomeration of people. I mean, the very beginning, this is one of those types of movies where you have a scene at the beginning, which is really happening at the end of the movie. And then most of it's in flashback. But when they were showing that scene the first, the camera's going across and you see people dressed in like what look like Vikings and you see some conquistadors. I looked at my wife and I said, what did Hammer just open up the fashion vault and say, put on whatever you want.
We got a size 4 over here. Anybody wear a size 4? Hey, you know, I got a size 12 shoe over here. Yeah, just whatever. Oh, man. You know, I'm glad I watched the movie, but it does seem to kind of just fall apart and go kind of nuts. You've got this random assortment of people, Vikings, conquistadors, this weird religious dude wearing something that looks uncomfortably like something a Klansman would wear.
Yep.
A giant scorpion, a giant crab, killer seaweed, fleshy looking monster things, and phosphorus comes back into the end of the film. I don't know. It's just kind of wacky. I almost feel like we had two different movies here.
Oh, definitely. The first 70% of this film reminded me of a very melodramatic Love Boat kind of type of thing. And the last 30% of the film was a very science fiction, almost a lost in space. We're lost on a weird planet and weird things are attacking us. The two didn't marry up very well. And quite honestly, you know, I had seen parts of the last part, which I really liked. I really wanted the ship to get there quicker and have more time of them. I would like to know, you know, the other ships that are there, how long have they been there? Are the people that are from the Spanish Inquisition, have they been there since the Spanish Inquisition? Is this, you know, a different ancestors of those that have lived on this ship the whole time and the Vikings? I want to know more about this world.
Yeah, it's such an interesting, I mean, messed up.
Oh, very society. Much so. Yeah.
But I would like to know a little bit more about that. Are they the original kings? Are they descendants of? Where did El Supremo come from?
Yeah.
The guy's a teenager. He's clearly, I mean, he's probably been there his entire life, which means he had a mother. Where's the mom? You know, what led to all of this? What set up this structure, this weird religious cult-like structure? It could be fascinating. It really felt like this part of the film was more of a Jules Verne story than what Dennis Wheatley would be known for.
That is a very accurate description. And I also want to know what happened to the mutineers.
Well, maybe the seaweed got them.
Yeah. Even though I had seen the end of the movie and I don't remember them showing up, I kind of expected them to show up at the end of the movie and help them for some odd reason. You know, they were the ones that were going to save them.
That would have been cool. A little bit more Michael Ripper action.
Yeah.
Maybe a little bit more with the first officer with his incredibly blonde dyed hair job.
You know, when the crew gets captured, or most of them gets captured, and they're in front of El Supremo, and the captain and a couple others break them out, I would like that to have been the mutineers that they found their ship, got some of the phosphorus, and then they helped attack. They had the idea because they dealt with the phosphorus set.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Yeah, it would have been a neat – I mean, the way it ends is pretty spectacular. I mean, it's a big set piece thing. Start catching on fire. Apparently, not just Eddie Powell, but one of the other actresses got burned as well. Not one of our leads, but somebody – one of the conquistadors, one of the people of the lost quote-unquote continent got burned as well. I mean, it's pretty spectacular. It's pretty big. How we get to this point seems pretty – I don't know, shallow. It needs more flushing out.
Oh, it does.
How did the captain get there? How did he find it? When did he build a catapult to launch the phosphorus from the boat?
The big question I want to know is the how did he get there? Because when Sarah leaves, she takes one of those balloon snowshoe type things to walk across the seaweed. And then they take the other ones that they had captured to go out and look for. They didn't have any more of those things. So how did he get there?
Well,
how did he cross the seaweed?
I guess they had the prisoner there that they made to talk. Did he maybe tell them how to get there?
Well, they also had a little barge that they had with them, but they still couldn't get near the boat because the seaweed surrounding the Spanish boat, they had to cross it to get to it. How did they do that?
I don't know. Magic.
A wizard did it.
That's right. I don't know. I also know
that, yeah, they saw the people, the inhabitants of the Lost Continent, walking across the seaweed with these balloons and snowshoes. Logic dictates, okay, that's how you do it. But I would like just a throwaway line, oh, these make you light enough so that the seaweed doesn't know you're walking across it or something.
You know, I was going to say, I actually appreciated that they didn't do that.
I mean, I don't want to go into a full scientific, yeah, we need balloons that will cut your weight by 74%. It makes you lighter so they don't trigger the seaweed.
Okay.
And I also want more realistic looking balloons.
Well, yeah, there is that too. I didn't buy, I mean, I bought that they were balloons, but I didn't buy that they were, okay, when I say balloons, I mean, probably in the strictest, most scientific sense, I believe that they were balloons. I didn't believe that that's what made the things float.
I didn't even believe they were balloons because it looked like they had rigid poles connecting them to the body. They reminded me of the things that you see a lot of people wear, like for New Year's, on their head with the springs, and they had the little balls on the top of them.
Sure.
They weren't balloons at all. They were plastic things on the end.
Well, that's what I mean. I believe they were balloons in the strictest sense, since that they were hollow and they were filled with air. I don't believe that they were free at all. I think you're right. They were attached to those harnesses with rigid rods, and there was no floating or structure in the balloon or that bubble itself at all. Yeah, exactly. I agree with you 100%. You know, Sarah, why did she leave the boat?
Yeah, that's what I was talking about earlier. She mentions that she needs to go, and her people would be worried about her and looking for her.
But she was running from her people to begin with.
No. I thought she was part of the attacking group. I don't know what happened. Then I'm confused on how she got there in the first place.
I thought she was like running from them, like they were coming to get her for some reason. I don't know.
Yeah, now that you said that, I think you're right. What? Maybe she just, any port in a storm, she saw them and.
Okay. Well, I mean, clearly, we have some problems with the film. But overall, for you, thumbs up, thumbs down.
Before I say that, I do want to read a couple of reviews that I found.
Oh, okay. What do you got?
from Films and Filming from August 1968, they said, "This is one of the most ludicrously enjoyable bad films." And the New York Times in June 1968 called the film marvelously absurd.
Marvelously absurd. Okay.
And I kind of agree with those reviews.
All right.
I didn't have a bad time watching the film, but I could have used less pre-hurricane and more post-hurricane.
Yeah.
I want to know more about that world.
Yeah, that's, I think, where I am as well. Now, I haven't read much Wheatley at all, and I keep telling myself I'm going to go back and read more Dennis Wheatley because I really like The Devil Rides Out a lot. And just the idea of occult investigations and all that thrills me. But this is truly a book that he didn't remember writing. I don't know if it's even something I want to go track down and read. So I don't know. I'm glad I watched it. Is it something I'm going to go back to over and over and over again? No.
No. I would go back and watch The Devil Rides Out before this one easily, and I'd be more interested in reading that than this book.
Exactly. Yeah, I'm right there with you. I did respect that, and here's a massive spoiler – El Supremo doesn't make it.
Yes.
He does have that turn and like, oh, okay, I'll go with the captain. Okay.
I got the impression that he was just brainwashed by the Inquisitor.
Yeah.
And did everything the Inquisitor told him. And he saw this as a way to get out from under his control.
Right.
It wasn't explained very well. That was just the inference I made.
Yeah. The captain makes quite a jump to, he's just a kid. He's just a puppet. I'm like, okay. Well, I'll go with him then. But I did appreciate that. Wow. Those words just about came out of my mouth. I appreciated that the kid died. I did respect that because I don't think I expected that.
No.
Even for Hammer, I didn't expect the minor, basically a child, even though he's 17, you know, to be killed.
Even though they do foreshadow that at the beginning, because it's his funeral that they're at the beginning scene. And they said they mentioned something about his being really young.
Right. But no, I did appreciate that. I did respect that. This wasn't into the nihilistic 70s of genre films. So just it was kind of like, oh, well, that's a bold choice.
Yes. Yeah.
Oh, well. I mean, it's an interesting film. I think some of the monster stuff is fun. I think the seaweed is cool. I think the fleshy seaweed monster is cool. And I even kind of like the giant scorpion a little bit. But you're talking to the guy who produces Monster Kid Radio. I love monster stuff. So give me the monsters. I want more of that, too.
And that's easily my favorite parts of this film, too.
Yeah. Yeah.
I did like the scorpion. And you said that the other one was a crab. He looked more like a rock monster to me.
Oh, whatever he was.
You cut out. I didn't hear what you just said there.
Whatever he was, and then my brain went to the B-52s for some reason.
Yes, well, of course, that's why I said rock monster. It's a rock monster.
Oh, boy. We can't afford the rights to that. Stop it.
Well, that's why we're not actually going to play it.
How can people see this? It's not easy.
No, it's not easy.
It's out of print right now. I think Anchor Bay put it out at one point on DVD, but it's out of print right now.
Yeah,
unless you know something more, I don't.
No. No, it is out of print and very difficult to find.
I believe when it was released on DVD by Anchor Bay, it was a double feature release, and that typically means not a lot of special features. but I don't know for sure.
And if I remember correctly, I did read that when it was released to theaters, it was a double feature with The Vengeance of She.
Well, so you get a little double Dana Gillespie right there for you, right?
Yes.
Long-time listeners know that The Vengeance of She is one of Scott's absolute favorite films of all time.
Keep listening to MKR to find out if that is a true statement.
Yeah. So the movie was also released on DVD in the UK. Optimum Releasing was the one who released that. And I think it was released in Spain as well, but it's missing some – either missing or actually – I think it actually has a little extra footage. I'm not sure. There's not a lot of extra stuff in it. There is like a couple of minutes here and there, but that's about it. Nothing that really adds a lot to the film. But yeah, so that's The Lost Continent. How do you feel after doing Down Place after, what, 6, 7, 8 months?
I'm glad to be back.
Me too. Me too. I miss recording with you, sir.
Casey's Kidney Stone, what do you think?
I had a great time.
I can't wait to come back and talk about another Hammer film.
We need to find somebody like at Fiverr.com or something who can do like a Mickey Mouse voice and have them do the voice of Casey's Kidney Stone. Oh, boy.
Oh, boy.
That wasn't half bad.
No. That was actually pretty good, Scott. Right on. No, it's good to be back. Good to be doing this again. Like we said, we're going to go quarterly moving forward. If things change, obviously we would love to do more often, but real life gets in the way of things sometimes. That said, even though we've got 3 months before the next episode, we know what we're doing in 3 months. What's coming up next? We're going to do a Hammer Dracula film, aren't we? Please.
This is news to me, so.
Oh, did I just have this conversation in my head?
You must have.
Wow. And here I'm all excited about my hand saying, please, Scott, please, can we do Dracula? Can we do Dracula? What's the next Dracula film in our Dracula filmography that we've done here on the show? Do you remember the last one we did?
Dracula's Risen from the Grave, maybe?
The episode list is taking forever to come up right now. So.
That was episode 49 in October 2015.
Oh, it really isn't coming up right now for me.
And then we did Phantom Ship. Then we did the Hammer House of Horror episode, The House That Bled to Death. The Pirates of Blood River, The Kiss of the Vampire, Prehistoric Women, The Two Faces of Dr. Jekyll, The Reptile, The Horror of Frankenstein, and then the two missing episodes on The Unholy Four and Curse of the Mummy's Tomb. And then we were going to do the To the Devil a Daughter and then Taste the Blood of Dracula.
Okay, Taste the Blood of Dracula is the next one in the run. It is the fifth Dracula film, the fourth starring Christopher Lee. I remember really liking the setup to this film.
Feel the cold grip of his presence. Sense the clammy excitement of his evil. Taste the sharp fear that he alone can bring. Dracula's blood.
This way, gentlemen.
We know the way.
These men thought they had tasted all that life had to offer.
Ready when you are, gentlemen.
Would you be willing to sell your souls to the devil?
If one thought that one's experience might be extended.
It would be extended to infinity.
There's someone there.
Dracula is back. To choose his human victims.
Alice.
Who are you? How do you know my name?
Dracula is back to select his companions in darkness, who must die that he may live. If you shock easily, stay away.
She's neither dead nor alive.
Lucy! 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 Paxton! Paxton, listen to me! The marks on her neck! She's a vampire!
Prepare yourself. Every nerve, every muscle.
No.
Prepare yourself for the greatest shock of all.
What do you think? Can we do this one next?
Sure. I have not seen it, so I'm good to seeing that one.
Right on. Yeah, I remember really liking it the first time I saw it, but it's been years, so I'm looking forward to revisiting that. 1970s, The Taste of Blood of Dracula. That's coming up next. So if you have any thoughts or comments on Taste of Blood of Dracula, dear listener, we would love for you to share that with us.
And you can call us at area code 765-203-1951. You can email us at podcast@1951downplace.com or find us in Facebook by searching for 1951 Downplace there.
And listeners, if you have anything you want to say about any previous episode of 1951 Downplace, you can always contact us that way as well. And we'll include you in an upcoming episode.
Sounds good.
Now, I mentioned that I may be changing the feed for this. That's all behind the scenes. That's all stuff that's happening on our side. So listeners, on your side, nothing changes. You don't have to go resubscribe to anything, I don't think. If there are going to be any changes to anything in terms of how you get the show in the future, well, we'll make sure that listeners know how to do that. Just keep your iPod and whatever podcatcher you use tuned to the same channel, same bat time thing. And yeah, you'll be kept up to date.
Same Dracula time.
There we go. There you go. Same Dracula time. We also be kept up to date. Scott can always be found at Disney Indiana at DisneyIndiana.com every other week. Some of the best Disney podcasting in the business right there with his wife, Tracy.
And you can find Derek at this show's parent podcast, Monster Kid Radio.
As of right now, MonsterKidRadio.net, but we may also have another website down the line as well. Again, stuff I want to talk to Scott about off mic. I'm just piling it all on Scott. I'm like, yeah.
And
we're talking about this next time around. We're going to be doing this and that and that. Oh, okay.
And I'm going on vacation.
Yeah. Well, Casey's kidney stone and I will work out the details and we'll have it ready for you when you get back.
It sounds good.
Oh, boy.
Oh, boy.
That's really good.